My name is Sally Steenland, and I direct the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Rabbi Dennis Ross, a teacher, writer, advocate, and congressional rabbi who serves Congregation Beth Emth in Albany, New York. Rabbi Ross is also the director of Concerned Clergy for Choice, a nationally recognized multi-faith network of religious leaders who support reproductive rights. Rabbi Ross frequently appears in the media and has written for the New York Times, the Boston Globe, Jewish Daily Forward, and many other outlets. His most recent book is called All Politics is Religious, Speaking Faith to Policymakers, the Media, and in the Community. Rabbi Ross has taught at Hebrew Union College, Manhattanville College, Williams College, and the University of Massachusetts Medical School, where he taught biomedical ethics. Wow, that's a pretty impressive resume. So welcome, Rabbi Ross. We're so glad you're with us today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation and for those very generous words of introduction.
Well, they're all true. So let's start with your most recent book. The title is really intriguing, and what's between the covers is intriguing, too. It's called All Politics is Religious, Speaking Faith to the Media, Policymakers, and Community. In your book, you say that faith helps us uphold a vision for a better world and that we should talk about faith in the public square, and at the same time, we should keep church and state separate. So how do we do all that?
Wow. Well, that's a good question and a really big question to answer. But you know, I think that everybody who lives in this country has a right, well, really a responsibility to make their beliefs known in the public square with policymakers in the community. And we don't lose that right. Really, it's an obligation because that's the only way our country will work. We don't lose that right just because we're religious. So I think, you know, even though we have separation of church and state, I think all people, including people of faith, have a responsibility to share their ideas with the community and with the press and with policymakers, and at the same time, we can have separation of church and state.
So let me just follow up on that for a minute. So really, what you're saying is that separation of church and state means more than just freedom to worship. It also means, you know, you are allowed and even obligated, as you say, to bring your religious views, your beliefs, and to argue them in the public square. I've had conservatives complain to me, and what they say is, you know, there's a real double standard here. Now, progressive faith leaders, you know, you say it's fine that when people bring their faith into politics when it comes to protecting the environment or a women's right to choose, we really like that. But when conservatives lobby to protect unborn life, or when they say we're working for family values and it's a political agenda we don't like, then we say, oh, guess what? You're not allowed to do that. So is there a double standard, or is there really a kind of a difference going on here?
Well, yeah, I think it's a great question. It's one that I get asked a lot, and that you probably get asked a lot in your work as well. When it comes to abortion rights, there's a big difference between what I'm asking for versus what opponents of abortion are asking for. They're asking for their religious restriction to be imposed on the whole country, that it's wrong in their faith, and therefore no one else in the entire country should be allowed to do it or have it. So that's their argument. My argument is different, that when it comes to religious restrictions in particular, there we have to keep church and state separate. And what we need then are laws and policies that allow, in this case, a woman to make her own personal private decision about her pregnancy, whether to raise a child, whether to opt for adoption, whether to end her pregnancy. She should be protected as she makes that personal decision, and for many women it's a religious or spiritual decision. She's entitled to that religious liberty, that privacy. Her needs come first. So first of all, as opposed to abortion opponents who are calling for their beliefs to be enshrined, to be codified as law, I'm calling for each one of us to have the personal, private, religious freedom that we're entitled to in our lives. So that's the first very, very big difference. The second major difference I want to point out is that many opponents of abortion simply point to their religious teaching and say it's forbidden and just assume that's the final word. We're in my denomination and many other denominations, you know, we make our feelings known, and this goes back to your first good question. We make our feelings known, but at the same time, we expect our policymakers to take other factors into consideration, like what is the public health need? What does science show? You know, so there are two very big differences for starts between what I'm saying and what people who disagree with me are saying.
So it sounds as if one thing you're saying is, you know, in a pluralistic democracy, everybody has the right to make their case and to argue their case. And you can, you know, go on TV, you can preach, you can stand on a soapbox in Central Park, you can do whatever, you can take out ads in the newspaper. That's free speech. You can do whatever you want. But there's a difference when it comes to codifying your particular theology into law. So then it becomes a legal matter, and then everybody, no matter whether they have a different faith or no faith, you know, their conscience tells them to do something else. They have to follow that law because you've been able to enshrine whatever you've argued into law. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. You know, we had a, you know, I work in New York State, and when our state legislature ratified marriage equality, we were in the halls lobbying, and so were the opponents. And the opponents started shouting, "God says no." So, you know, what are we going to say? Well, we believe God says yes, right? So
sure, absolutely.
So basically what you had here was a very clear religious disagreement, because other than religious opponents of marriage equality for same-gender couples, there was no other opposition. What they wanted the state to do was to walk in and referee what was essentially a religious dispute and declare one religion the winner. Now, the state didn't do that. Instead, we have a law that says to those religions who don't want marriage equality or see something wrong with it, they don't have to have these ceremonies in their houses of worship. The law protects them. Their clergy don't have to officiate at these ceremonies if they don't want to, if they don't believe in it. On the other hand, in my congregation and in many other denominations where we say that a same-gender relationship has the potential to be holy, where it reaches for the moral high ground and strengthens our communities, our ceremonies are recognized in the eyes of the state. So it's really a law that protects everyone's religious freedom and safeguards everybody's religious practice. And the state isn't playing favorites. People can do what they want to do in their own houses of worship, in their homes, and in their private lives, and act on their conscience and live as they believe. So here you have a situation where the state did right and allows each one of us religious liberty.
I'm really glad you said that and pointed that out, because to hear some conservatives talk about religious liberty, and it's an issue that really has been in the headlines this past year, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon, you'd think that religious liberty was hanging by a thread in this country and that it was really under assault. And you've just pointed out all of these religious exemptions where if you're at a house of worship and you don't believe in marrying same-sex couples or interfaith couples or old and, you know, intergenerational couples, whatever, you don't have to do that. And your religious liberty is protected. But what we hear are groups that are not houses of worship complaining that because of marriage equality laws, because of the contraceptive mandate in the healthcare law, if you're a religiously affiliated hospital, university, charity, and we're also now seeing for-profit groups like companies where the owner, the boss, happens to be religious, saying, well, you know, you're violating my religious freedom. I don't want to provide contraceptive coverage in healthcare plans for any of my employees, and there may be 10,000 employees of all different kinds of faiths. So what's your take on what's, you know, legitimate religious liberty issues and what isn't?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the birth control insurance provision, you know, under the Affordable Care Act, because as folks may know, beginning in last summer, insurance companies began covering birth control for women through the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, first you want to make clear, no one's getting free birth control. No one's giving out free birth control. The birth control coverage is paid for by the women who work and earn it. They own the insurance.
Right.
And, you know, it's theirs. So And what's happened is, when the reality is that the person who works and earns the insurance, like they earn their salary and earn their pension, also earn, you know, the insurance coverage for prescription birth control. So, and again, the Department of Health and Human Services has bent over backwards to try to accommodate these religious objections, and I believe they've reached a very fair and very equitable solution. There are over 350,000 churches, synagogues, mosques in this country who do not have to include birth control insurance coverage in their employer-sponsored health plans. These religious organizations already are exempt. What we're talking about now, with the dust-up is now, is hospitals with a religious affiliation. They are not arms of the church. They are not-for-profit businesses that hire people from all walks of life, provide secular services, and provide those services to people from all walks of life, too. These are not, these religiously affiliated hospitals are not religious institutions like churches, like synagogues, and the like. So what happens is they hire people from all across the religious spectrum, many of them whose faiths, like mine, recognize the moral good in access to birth control, and the needs of the insured woman, I think, carry a moral high ground over someone else's objection. So if she decides she needs basic health care, which is what birth control is, she should be able to get it under her insurance plan without her boss barging in and saying, gee, it's against my religion. You know, all we're asking is somebody in the human resources department to pass a few pieces of paper across their desk that have the words birth control written on it. That doesn't have the same moral claim as a woman at a pharmacy counter saying, you know, can I have my prescription refilled? She's the one who's gonna need that, and her, it's none of her boss's business. So I think, you know, the Health and Human Services, Department of Health and Human Services has made a wonderful accommodation. I think everybody ought to be satisfied with it, and life should move on. I should also add that here in New York State, we have a similar kind of policy in terms of insurance coverage for birth control. It's been on the books for a decade. It works well. It's been tested in the highest court in our state. It stands. There's a similar provision in California, and I hope the Affordable Care Act, when it comes to birth control, stands as it does, as it works its way through the courts.
I really like what you said about women earning their health insurance, which is absolutely right, as just the way your pension and your salary and other things as well. And I think another thing is nobody's forcing women to take this. This is an option for employees. And, you know, another thing that I think is important is This really would get murky in the weeds to deny women birth control if your boss didn't believe in family planning. Because, as you know, so many women take birth control pills for medical reasons. Their doctor prescribes it because it reduces their risk of ovarian cancer, or they have, you know, ovarian cysts or whatever it might
be.
And so then, I mean, it's like, what do? You, like, bring your doctor a note and you or your boss and say, see, you know, it's like maybe family planning plus, but I promise it's it's kind of horrible to even think of. It sounds very 19th century.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it would roll back the clock.
It would roll back the
clock.
In
a bad way, by decades and decades and decades.
Yeah, it sure would. So I want to follow up on this conversation about reproductive rights and justice to ask you about Concerned Clergy for Choice. That's a group that you direct. So it's got clergy, it's got choice, both in the same phrase. Tell us about the group, and in your view, you know, faith and then reproductive rights and justice, both together in the same sentence. A lot of people would say they wouldn't belong. How do you put them together?
Thanks. New York State, I work in New York State, where we have a very long and deep history in religious advocacy for reproductive rights and reproductive justice for women and families. The very first birth control clinic in the United States opened up in 1916. In Brooklyn.
Wow.
And in 1921,
wow. Wow.
I hit the Smith College archives, and I found a letter from Rabbi Maxwell Silver, of the Free Synagogue of Flushing, who invited the very first birth control educators and advocates to speak from the pulpit of his congregation here in New York. That's in 1921.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so this day, and then in 1970, the very first abortion clinic in the country opened in Manhattan on East 73rd Street. So this state has a very strong and wonderful history of advocacy for family planning services for women and families. So, you know, our work here at Concerned Clergy for Choice, we are a network of 1,000 clergy. We have ministers from Baptist, Methodist, Episcopal, Unitarian churches, and more. We have rabbis like myself. We have Muslim leaders and Buddhists. And, you know, we're quite a diverse bunch. And right now we are working with advocates here in New York State to enact the women's equality agenda proposed by Governor Cuomo. It's a 10-point agenda that would strengthen protections against human trafficking, help ensure equal pay for women at work, strengthen protections against sexual harassment, and make sure that a woman's health is protected through her pregnancy, which is a very important need here in New York State. New York was one of the first states to legalize abortion in 1970. It was a wonderful law in its time, but it has to be updated to protect the health of the woman. So that's what we're working for right now. The governor is very strongly behind it, and we're looking forward to seeing the legislation passed and enacted.
So if somebody, let me just play devil's advocate for a minute. If somebody said to you, you're a man of God, how can you be in favor of, you know, a woman killing her baby? How can you be in favor of abortion? So give me a moral argument. Give me what you say to that.
Well, you know, first of all, you know, it's a good question. And first of all, you know, I'm not taking a position on abortion or not. It's really for the woman to make her decision. We don't walk in her shoes. We don't know what her life is like. Oh, she's really the expert in herself. And it's not for any legislative body or religious leader to barge into her life and tell her you have to carry your pregnancy to term. Secondly, in my faith and in many faiths, we understand that a pregnancy has a moral standing. However, if the woman's moral standing is higher, it's her decision making, it's her life, it's her responsibility to determine her destiny and her future. And making sure that she's able to do that, we make sure she has access to birth control. We want to make sure she and her teens have sex education. And we want to make sure that if she and her doctor decide that her pregnancy isn't right for her, that she should be able to, you know, take the steps she needs to take to end it, and be able to get safe and legal abortion.
One thing I find often in talking to faith leaders is one reason they are, if you want to say pro-choice, it's because the issue is not theoretical. So oftentimes when women are making this decision, they talk to their clergy, they talk to their rabbi, they talk to their priest or their minister. And so faith leaders like yourself, you hear stories. And I think what changes theory into a more complex reality is just hearing what some of those real stories are. I think it makes it a lot harder to judge.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, to go back to the other your previous question, then move into this one. My faith has a different teaching, and many faiths have different teachings about the Bible, about the nature of God, about what happens after we die. And we also have a different teachings about intimate life. And one faith may have one teaching about abortion. Mine has a different one. And you're right that our teachings are informed by our experience as pastors to women and families. Gosh, it was a number of years ago, I was at the cemetery for a ceremony for an older woman, and the son of the deceased points to a grave of a woman who died. She maybe was in her early 20s. Well, she died around 1935 or so. And he says, Rabbi, this was my aunt. She died of a botched abortion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and, you know, that shouldn't happen to a woman.
Right.
Because her moral standing takes precedence. Her health, her decision-making, she comes first in my faith.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, thank you. I want to ask you, so it sounds like one of your priorities as you look in 2013 this year, you're going to be working hard for the women's equality agenda for that legislation to pass. Are there other priorities for you that may be legislative, may not be legislative, when you look at your list of things that feel important to you in the coming days? And then just related to that is, you know, some of this work is very challenging. And so when you get up in the morning, if it's a gray, cold day, what gives you energy and what gives you hope so that you say, okay, I'm going to go to work today and not just turn over and put the covers over
my head? Right. Well, you know, one of the things that motivated me to write All Politics is Religious is that we too often hear, as you found in your work, we too often hear only one side of the religious spectrum when it comes to intimate life.
Right.
So it's really important that our communities hear from everybody, and we find that many of our clergy aren't sure what to say, or they need support, or they need you know, or they just need help, and they want to work with others in showing that their whole faith, their whole denomination, has a certain approach to sex education for teens or access to birth control. So, you know, I think it's one of the most important things to me is empowering our clergy with the skills, with the knowledge, with how to use social media, how to talk to the press, how to decide whether or not to take an interview when you get a press call, how to understand all these things that we never really learn in seminary, but we knew we need to know. I mean, when I was first ordained, and I'd get a call from a reporter, I thought I had to answer that question on the spot.
Right. It was like a test.
Where nobody in the world does that, and even the you know, reporters don't expect you to.
Right.
So I had a lot to learn, and our clergy. Also, we also have a wonderful Day of Advocacy, Clergy Day, on April 22nd in Albany, New York, where religious leaders from across the state will be coming to the state capitol to call for the passage of the Women's Equality Agenda. And again, this is a bill that keeps church and state separate. It protects religious liberty, and it will protect the well-being of all the women and families in New York State. What gets me out of bed in the morning? You know, it's this. I was a congregational rabbi for 25 years, and you know, I had written a couple of books. I was a licensed social worker, as you mentioned. I taught bioethics, and I always saw myself as a congregational rabbi, and never imagined myself doing anything else. And I left my congregation in Massachusetts, and a few people said, you know, you should look into this position with Family Planning Advocates and directing Concerned Clergy for Choice and working with Planned Parenthood. And this was 9 years ago. And when I interviewed for the job and I was offered it and accepted, I had no idea where I would what I would be doing. And it's, you know, a whole new window of living out the social justice teaching that I was preaching about, seeing how religion plays out in making public policy, and especially here in New York State, you wouldn't think, but there are religious lobbyists in the Capitol day and day, each day of the week. They're sharing their beliefs while trying to impose their beliefs about intimacy onto others who follow different faith teachings. They are advocating for funding, for public funding for religious education. They're talking about a host of things that, you know, people just don't know about. So I think it's getting the word out that, you know, and the other thing I found is that our policymakers really want to hear what we think. They want to hear what their constituents think. They want to hear what their clergy think. They want to hear what their faith communities think. They hear much less from the public than you might expect, and most of it is, you know, and the other thing is most of what they hear is negative. You know, people are calling to complain, and I think the most important thing, one of the most important things I learned here is that when a policymaker does something you like, call up and say thanks. You see them on TV. They need that. They need to hear that. They count those calls. And they really get noticed. I was giving a speech in Barney Frank's district, former Congressman Frank district, and I said, you know, you got to call your congressman and tell him what you think. And somebody said, why should I call Barney Frank? I mean, he's perfect on every issue. Because if you count every issue, there may be 2 dozen. And when he hears from you, he will know which one to put first, you collectively. So he's a one guy with a limited staff, and he has to prioritize. You're going to help him.
Right.
And look, everybody likes to hear a word of thanks. All this is very important. So, you know, I after all my years as a congregational rabbi, I'm now a religious advocate, and, I work with a wonderful team here at Family Planning Advocates, and, I just love the work.
Well, I want to give you a word of thanks because I really appreciate your including women's reproductive health as a core issue. We know that these are tricky issues to talk about. A lot of people shy away from them, see them as sideline issues, not important as economic issues or other issues, when we know they actually are closely connected to economic issues. And
right.
It really is a very core issue. And I also think you are, as you said earlier, religion in some ways is a damaged brand among a lot of people because it's perceived as, very negative, sort of backward looking and even bigoted. And when you're out there, in the public square and you're presenting a different view, you're connecting these issues as important and you're a person of faith. And so I think that's really an important thing to do too. So huge thanks from
all
of us for this really good work you're doing. And thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for the invitation. I really enjoyed our time together.
Take care.
Thanks.